Hello, this is episode number 17 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Friday, June 14th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. We have several interesting issues up for discussion this week. First, Fred Von Lohmann makes the case for collective licensing on college campuses in a Washington Post editorial. Second, Tim Lee makes the case against software patents in a New York Times editorial. And finally, Google brings an antitrust complaint against Microsoft's desktop search software. Joining me to discuss these topics are Technology Liberation Front contributors Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
And Braden Cox of the Association for Competitive Technology. Hi, Braden.
Hey, Adam.
And our special guest this week is Fred Von Lohmann of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Hello, Fred.
Hi, Adam.
Well, first we're going to turn to Fred Von Lohmann. And, Fred, you had a very interesting editorial in the Washington Post this week talking about the idea of collective licensing on college campuses. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and what you're proposing in that editorial?
Sure. The editorial was spurred really by a litigation campaign and a congressional effort on the part of the recording industry to do something about what they view as the serious problem of peer-to-peer file sharing on college campuses. I think anybody who's paying any attention to what college kids are up to knows full well that a lot of college kids get their music from downloads from unauthorized peer-to-peer networks and from swapping CDs among friends and all kinds of other sources for which the recording industry is not paid. Unfortunately, the responses by the recording industry so far haven't been terribly creative and haven't been terribly successful. So we've seen lawsuits in the last 4 months against 1,600 college kids, an additional 400 being filed every month. And we're also seeing a lot of pressure being put on university presidents in a number of House hearings on the topic. And generally speaking, what the recording industry has been asking for has been network monitoring tools and greater penalties, including up to and including expulsion for students who are caught downloading music. Well, the point I was trying to make in the editorial is we really can't expect a sensible system to develop here if your only solution is to sue kids and throw them out of school. That seems like a pretty both futile and useless approach. So what we suggested and what EFF has been talking about on this front for some years is why not try out some sort of collective licensing approach, where the university would collect a fee from the students, a monthly fee, a handful of dollars, if you will, and pay that over to the recording industry. And in exchange for that, the recording industry backs off on the lawsuits and takes the money and divides it up among their companies and the creators themselves. That at least puts us on a path where artists and rights holders are getting paid and lets universities go back to the job of educating students.
Now, Fred, there are other types of collective or even compulsory licensing schemes at work in the world of copyright. I mean, does your proposal build on any of those or mimic them in any way?
Sure. Yes, there are a number of other collective licensing approaches in copyright, in the copyright industry in the United States today. And in fact, a lot of economists have pointed out that in markets that show enforcement difficulties, collective licensing is often the most efficient mechanism to, efficient market mechanism to solve the problem. So perhaps the best known example of that in the United States is the way radio stations pay rights holders, in particular music composers, songwriters, for the right to play their music on the air. There are three collective societies in the United States, ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. Those three entities are independent commercial entities. They were formed voluntarily by rights holders themselves. It was not something that was compelled by the government. The two largest, ASCAP and BMI, are governed by an antitrust consent decree because of their collective market share. But CSAC is not. So we do have here a free market where rights holders can get together and form these entities. And so when it comes to FM, radio broadcasts, for example, radio station pays these three entities. Having paid them, they're entitled to play whatever they like, whenever they like, without having to ask permission in advance, song by song or anything like that. The money goes into these collecting societies and then is divided up among their respective members. And, you know, that actually has worked very well for songwriters now for many decades, since at least the 20s and 30s when radio really sort of took off. As the same model is used for universities, ironically enough, today. Most university campuses pay ASCAP, BMI, CSAC licenses in order to permit, you know, musical groups on campus to play the songs, a cappella groups to sing songs, things like that. So we have a model there that has worked quite well, and in fact, in the last 10 years, sort of the digital revolution that's been so hard for the recording industry, collecting societies like ASCAP and BMI have actually thrived and have shown strong profits and growing profits, and have enabled a number of new market uses, including what they've done for webcasting. So here we have a great precedent, and I am the first to admit that my idea for collective licensing on campuses is inspired by the job that collecting societies have done in other parts of the copyright industry.
So, Fred, these other collecting societies, is it a per-song rate that radio stations and universities pay, or is it a flat fee where they pay $1,000 a year or something, and then they don't have to monitor how much music they actually play?
It's a flat fee. So radio stations will pay a quarterly fee, I believe, and it's usually based on their geographic reach and some estimate of their number of listeners. Also, they are not required to report every song that they play. In fact, instead, the collecting societies rely on a sampling-based system that is a combination of partial reporting. So radio stations generally have a week a year, I think, where they do keep records and report what they played during that single week. And also they rely on outside broadcast monitoring as well, so that they have companies that listen to radio stations periodically, and based on all that data, they come up with a statistical model that gives us a pretty good idea of what was played. In the online context, I think we could certainly do not only that, but we could actually no doubt gather even better data and get an even better statistical model, given the reality of you know, how many, you know, the kind of monitoring and sampling you could do online. Obviously, you need to be careful about privacy. I think in the university context, I've always said that, you know, it would be sort of fun to have students be able to be Nielsen families for their universities. We manage to divide up billions of dollars of television advertising revenue every year with a sample-based model built on so-called Nielsen families. I'm sure you could get probably several hundred students at every campus to volunteer to play that role. That combined with, again, sort of the kind of monitoring that we've recording industry and companies like Big Champagne already do of peer-to-peer networks should give us a pretty good sense of what's moving and who's listening and downloading what without forcing people to compromise their privacy. So that would be the idea. The money would be collected. The university is obviously in a unique position because the students are all paying the university already. The university is their source of internet access for most, at least, students that live on campus. So you have here a gatekeeper who's well positioned to collect those funds. It will be pretty difficult, I think, for students to free ride. And moreover, there's not much incentive to free ride. Presumably this fee would be built into a tuition bill or some other regular bill students pay. So they are unlikely to feel it as a separate charge that they would want to evade. For example, if students pooled their internet activities, it wouldn't make much difference because they would still need network access for other kinds of activities as well. So we have in the university, I think, an opportunity that is more efficient, potentially more successful than what we might face in the internet at large.
Fred, let me ask you two questions, though, about that, because if we're asking the university to essentially be the intermediary who collects these fees, I take it, or helps figure out how to make the system work, are there any burdens that this places on the university system that we need to be aware of, or how are those going to be allocated or paid for? And then secondly, are you at all concerned about the broader issue that some people have raised about the growing sort of deputization of the middleman in the internet environment that internet intermediaries or others like universities are increasingly being asked to take a greater role in helping enforce on behalf of people below them or that they provide service for?
Well, those are very good questions, and I actually think the same answer largely applies to both. The reality today is intermediaries are already being pushed into this role. So from my perspective, what I'd like to see happen is that intermediaries are going to be asked and, in fact, pushed into this role. I would much rather have a system that at least manages to create an efficient market-based solution on the one hand, and also one that protects privacy and civil liberties as well. So to take the universities, for example, they're already being asked to hand over the IP addresses of students who are downloading. After all, that's how the 1,600 students who have been sued, that's how their names were disgorged to the recording industry for those lawsuits. It was only after university administrators had received subpoenas and letters, pre-litigation letters from the recording industry. Moreover, the recording industry and the motion picture industry have been demanding in front of Congress that universities install sophisticated network monitoring tools. So we already have universities shouldering an administrative burden and a technological burden that costs them hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and none of that money is going to artists, none of that money is going to rights holders, and none of that money, frankly, is stemming or I think making a difference in student behavior. I think they're going to, students are copying the music from one source or another, whether you pick 400 a month out or not. So we already have intermediaries bearing the expense. I'd rather see that expense go to a sensible long-term solution that actually gets artists paid. And in the long run, I think takes the middleman, if not completely out of the equation, at least minimizes the likelihood that they will have to do things that will infringe privacy, that will undermine the kind of civil liberties that we all, I think, deserve. Certainly, I can imagine if you'd gone back to another time and said to universities, oh, we'd like you to monitor all of your communications networks in order to report any suspected incidents of unlawful behavior. If we imagine such a request coming from the government, I think everyone would, the university community would, as with one voice, and rightly so, refuse and say, we will not be monitored. We are institutions of higher learning, and that would be a terrible outcome. And so from my perspective, to see that same outcome arise thanks to copyright strikes me as very bizarre. And so, you know, copyright is an incentive system. It's supposed to get artists and rights holders compensated for their efforts. I think we can get that job done on university campuses without resorting to the kind of punitive lawsuits and network monitoring that we've seen so far. So, you know, intermediaries, for better or for worse, it seems to me that everyone is going to push them into doing something, whether legislatively or through these lawsuits. So if we're going to do that, if that seems to be something that's hard to avoid, then I think we should do it in a way that is a real long-term solution.
What about for the student who says, well, is it fair to me that I'm going to be forced into a collective licensing system if I'm not an active and regular music downloader? Won't there be some people sort of caught in this net, essentially in some way paying in or contributing that aren't in any way responsible for it? Or isn't the university having to pick up costs for just a handful of people? I'm just pushing back with what arguments I have heard from others.
Well, I certainly am sympathetic to that argument. That obviously is a problem of collective compensation schemes in many contexts. As you may know, EFF, in urging a similar solution for the internet, the public internet more broadly, has urged this to be a voluntary option, right? That if you are a person who has residential broadband, you would be given the opportunity to purchase these additional services, these additional licenses, and you wouldn't be required to do so. And I think that is the best outcome, is to not force people to purchase things they don't need, both from a liberty point of view and an efficiency point of view. But I think, as many economists would say, in a collective situation, sometimes that ideal has to give way. I think the reality is that many, perhaps most, I think nearly all college students, you know, have some exposure to new music in that period of their life. I think if you look, for example, at the fees the universities already pay for ASCAP and BMI licenses to permit a cappella singers and musical groups to play on campus, obviously not every student is going to enjoy or avail themselves of those entertainment opportunities, but the university makes a decision that overall it makes more sense and is more efficient for them to pay a blanket license than it would be to give students a line item opt-out.
And this is broader than just music too, because it's, I mean, you know, when I was a student, I say didn't go to the gym very often, but my student fee, I still paid, you know, $10 a semester or something to, for the privilege of using that. So I would think that, you know, in an ideal world, we bill everybody for exactly what they use. But in the university context, students are always paying for things that many, but not all students use. And it does, I think, at least to some extent, balance out where everybody ends up paying for, you know, some things they use, and they end up getting some other things they use subsidized.
I think that's right, and a lot of economists actually will say that sometimes you shouldn't bill people for every single thing they use. And blanket payment systems have, for example, I think, been very successful at encouraging both internet use and cell phone use without charging people for every little bit. You know, so I think this is an experiment that would be worth trying. If it turns out that students rise up and say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to pay for something we don't use, then, you know, maybe we can evaluate whether universities should make it optional. If they did that, then, of course, they would have to bear the burden, the recording industry would have to bear the burden of continuing to enforce against those who are not paying. And that could, again, impose costs on the university to have to continue to respond to subpoenas and separate those who pay from those who don't pay on campus. And the university would have to just answer the question, are those administrative costs, you know, an efficient situation for them? Would they rather pay the blanket than pay the administrative costs?
Sylvie Singleton posted a blog on this, and you graciously commented to her on our blog. And you addressed everything, I think, that she mentioned, except for one thing that I'd like to hear about. This is kind of an interesting one, I think. Does this teach students the right thing? You know, this idea of kind of this all-you-can-eat world where they don't even have to think about it. Then they get out into the real world where you have to actually pay per song. You know, I don't know. I'm just asking this as kind of a – I don't know the answer to it, but what do you think on this?
Well, quite frankly, I think this is a circumstance where the market has to learn from the customer, rather than the customer being retrained or re-educated, to use the old communist word. yeah, I think it's quite clear that young folks today, in fact, I think most people, young or old, feel that there is nothing morally wrong with sharing the music that you are enthusiastic about with your friends. People have these technologies now. You know, this isn't something that's new. I mean, the recording industry would have you believe that somehow, suddenly, all America's youth became all at once a bunch of shoplifters. And I think that's just plainly ridiculous, right? People have been sharing music about which they are enthusiastic for decades and decades. Each time the technology changes, whether it be LP records or audio cassette or compact disc, and now MP3s and other digital formats, people have reacted exactly as I think anyone would have expected them to. They've said, hey, this is a way for me to share what I love with my friends, to find new friends who love the same music I love. And, you know, I think that's a perfectly natural human instinct. And unfortunately, the business models have not evolved in step with that very natural human desire. But if you think that college students are suddenly going to change their views because they are going to be urged by the recording industry to do the right thing, now I would simply point to the fact that, you know, 4 years now since the lawsuits began, you have more file sharing in the United States than ever before. So you have a situation where I think moral suasion is to miss the point. I think, and frankly, I think that's true of copyright law generally. It is not copyright law's goal to have everyone behave a particular way. It's copyright's goal to ensure an adequate source of compensation for rights holders. And as I pointed out, you already have examples of collective licensing approaches working very well in the marketplace without the need for government compulsory licenses, without the need for excessive government intrusion into those markets. I'd like to see that model be tried. And when artists are being compensated by college students, I think we'll have a happy coincidence of what the college students are going to do anyway with a system that gets artists and rights holders compensated.
Fred, we're gonna have to move on to our second issue here. Tim, you've had an editorial this week in the New York Times in which you made the case against software patents generally. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that and about the some of the pushback you've been getting on the blog?
Sure. Well, I wrote an article last Saturday about really about two controversies. One is the recent controversy over Microsoft's attempt to get the manufacturers and users of free software to pay royalties for unspecified software patents that they claim free software infringes. And then the other is the battle that we've talked about several times here on the podcast about between Verizon and Vonage over one of Verizon's patents. And what I pointed out is that Bill Gates has had a bit of changing perspective on this question of software patents back when he was running a relatively small company that was facing larger, more entrenched incumbents like Novell and IBM. He said that or he worried that larger companies would use the patent system as a way to stifle competitors. And now that that Microsoft is itself a large incumbent, it appears to me at least that they are doing exactly what Bill Gates feared that other companies would do to him, which is that they are using the patent system as sort of as a weapon against smaller companies that haven't amassed software patent portfolios of their own. And I think that Verizon is a particularly good example of this because Verizon is using a patent to really go after one of its most potent competitors. I believe Vonage is the most successful VoIP provider, at least excluding telecom and cable companies. And if Verizon succeeds with its patent lawsuit, it's very likely that Vonage will go into bankruptcy, and that will obviously harm consumers and will also send a very dangerous message to entrepreneurs that are thinking about entering new software model markets that have a lot of patents in them already, because they'll have to devote their capital not just to hiring engineers and programmers, but also to hiring patent lawyers to make sure that they're able to defend themselves against these kinds of lawsuits.
So you got some pushback from this from a few other bloggers, including our colleague Sylvie Singleton and Greg Aronian, who's well known in patent circles. What's the nature of their response been to you? Why don't you describe it, since you'll probably do a better job than I will.
Well, it's interesting. The thing I found striking about it is that, I mean, Sylvie in particular made several good points, sort of pushing back on the idea that the software patents are so bad. I mean, she thinks that that yes, there are some problems. But basically, I think her quibble is not so much with the point that the patent system is being abused, so much as that she questions whether software patents are uniquely the problem. And to some extent, I think she has a point. I mean, certainly the problems with the patent system are broader than software. I think there are problems with business method patents. I think there are problems with the obviousness standard. And so I'm certainly sympathetic to other reforms that would reduce the abuse of the patent system. But what I didn't see any critics really making the case for is why patents are needed at all in the software industry. I mean, certainly the other reform proposals that have been discussed are not mutually exclusive with changing the rules that the courts put in place in the 80s and 90s that first legalized software patents. And I don't To my knowledge, no one who's commented on the article has really explained, you know, what is the problem that software patents are supposed to solve, and what would be the problem if the courts, the Supreme Court, or Congress were to, you know, change the rules so that software is not eligible for patent protection.
I'd say Tim has hit the right question right on the head, which is what problem are these software patents, what problem are they supposed to solve? And it's always worth remembering whenever you look at an intellectual property question that this is a state-granted monopoly right, and it should only be tolerated in a circumstance where you feel the market wouldn't otherwise provide the level of creative activity you'd like. And when you look at the software market, it's pretty hard to say that but for software patents, that we would have an insufficient degree of investment in the industry. And quite the contrary, you see obviously very strong incentives for people to make software of many kinds using many different business models. So it is a bit of a mystery what problem is, you know, this particular government solution supposed to solve.
Well, Tim, I guess one of the concerns that others like Solvay and Gregoroni have is that this question of, you know, the concern about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I personally am very sympathetic to many of the concerns you raise. However, I think many people who have traditionally defended the patent system fear that an attack on software patents leads to a much broader-based attack on all patents.
Well, the first point is that software patents are a very new concept. The first Supreme Court the first Federal Circuit Court decisions changing the rules were in the 1980s, and they weren't formally legalized until the 1998 State Street decision. So it's really only been 10 years that patenting of effectively pure software has been unambiguously legal. And so the idea that if we change what might be considered a policy experiment that's been going on for only about 10 years, that somehow would be a radical attack on the patent system, I just think is absurd. I also think there are a couple of other ways that we can clearly distinguish software. I mean, if you're interested in drawing a bright line so that this doesn't become an attack on the patent system more broadly, in the first place, software is one of the very few industries that is covered by both the patent system and the copyright system, which, as Fred pointed out, doesn't make any sense. I mean, if the company already has copyright protection, the patent protection doesn't add very much. The other thing is that I think there's a very strong philosophical argument that software is fundamentally mathematical algorithms, and the Supreme Court has said very clearly that mathematical algorithms, as sort of laws of nature, are not patentable, and so. I think the best outcome would be for the Supreme Court to take a case on software patents and simply uphold the rules that they articulated in the 70s and the early 80s, saying that software by itself is not patentable.
When we talk about software patents, aren't we really just talking about method patents? I mean, isn't that what the State Street case was? I'm not the patent expert here, so I'm asking. And then would we have to then somehow make a distinction between some method patents and other method patents? Would we have to say method patents is expressed by software that runs on a computer would be not patentable or something like that? And would trying to define that be very difficult?
This is not something I've looked into a lot of detail myself. My understanding is that a lot of the software patents are not actually method patents, but device patents, where the device is a general-purpose computer running piece of software X. But in terms of distinguishing method patents, methods generally involve manipulation of some physical device. I mean, the Pythagorean theorem is a method, but you can't patent that because it's not. It's an abstract, mathematical method. And so the distinction that I would draw is the one that I think the court drew in its 1981 Diamond decision, which is that the method has to involve manipulating the physical world rather than simply manipulating bytes and bits within the computer's memory, which is what a lot of these modern software patents, I mean, for example, the Verizon patent on the OIP, what it patented was the concept of translating between an IP address and a phone number, which is just data. It's just manipulating ones and zeros. And so that by itself would not be patentable.
Okay, guys, we're going to need to move on to our third and final issue of the week, which is Google bringing an antitrust complaint against Microsoft's desktop search software. Brad, you've been following this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on and why it's a big deal?
Sure. Well, it's a big deal because it was a lead story on the front page of the Sunday Times this past weekend, where the New York Times published a story that Google filed a complaint, which was actually in November of last year, with the Department of Justice regarding desktop search in Windows Vista. And they're able to do this because of the ongoing Microsoft antitrust issues that allow third-party complaints to be filed. And the 2001 consent decree with the U.S. Department of Justice and 8 states sets up this process. Now, Google contends that Windows Vista's built-in search feature is anti-competitive because the search indexer can't be turned off. And this brings us to the interesting question here of what I call integration innovation. Now, you know, this is something that's not particular software, but it's certainly something that we see technology firms and software firms doing all the time now. And, you know, we could geek out and discuss whether search is actually middleware, and that gets into some of the antitrust definitions and what that covers. But I think that the broader public policy decisions or issues here is whether we want antitrust to just kind of get involved in an ongoing micromanagement of what features software companies can integrate into their software products and platforms, and then especially ones that consumers are demanding. And then also, you know, this is the other context. I think Google could be hurting themselves by bringing up this issue because they're a company that's innovating through integration all the time, especially with their on-demand desktop products and everything they're doing too. It's you know, Tim, I think, brought up at one point on at least one of his blogs with patents, at least, that we shouldn't be using competition. We shouldn't be litigating competition by litigation, and I think that's what Google's trying to do here.
I think it is a very problematic to have the government be deciding sort of which features of an operating system are essential and which are not essential. I mean, it seems fundamentally an operating system is just a bundle of features. If you get, you know, above the very, very low level, pretty much all the features are optional and could be provided by a third party. And so it seems to me that we've sort of opened a Pandora's box where the state is in the position of sort of eyeballing features and saying, well, this one is clearly part of the operating system, but this one is a separate product that ought to be competitive. But I'm not sure that we really can close that Pandora's box since we've already started making these decisions. It's kind of a mess.
I largely agree. I think it's a very hard question. I agree we don't want courts micromanaging the design of software, whether in the antitrust context or in the copyright context. But at the same time, I think the threat, the possibility of that has actually resulted in a much more competitive market for lots of features. I think most people who observe the relevant portions of the software industry will admit that Microsoft appears to be acting more cautiously about sort of leveraging its operating system market share, thanks to the possibility that the DOJ anyone else out there might get involved and try to push them on it. So, you know, to the extent that that is brushing them back off the plate and thereby giving all consumers the benefits of a more competitive marketplace, I don't know. It's a hard question. I think economists will probably never be able to empirically answer the question about whether or not all the Sturm und Drang over the Microsoft antitrust situation has ended up being better or worse for consumers overall.
I think that's a good point, Fred, and I just wanted to comment on something that Braden said at the end of his comments, which I think is important, which is that regardless of what you think of the merits of Google's complaint in this matter, it strikes me that Google's playing a very dangerous game here politically. I mean, for those of us who are here inside the Beltway in D.C. right now, it seems like the Google and Google issues are just sucking all the oxygen out of the room at a lot of congressional hearings and a lot of DOJ. I mean, whether it's data retention or privacy or online free speech, Google's increasingly at the center of a lot of these political battles. So the comment I'm making here is more sort of about the political economy that Google's dealing with now, and it's dangerously close to turning against Google in a very serious way. And here they are filing a major complaint. Again, perhaps it has merits. I personally don't believe it does, but perhaps it does. Regardless, that playbook, I think, is going to be turned against Google here very soon. We already know they're in some deep doo-doo over in the EU on the privacy and data retention front. And so I don't know. I just think that Google's potentially borrowing a playbook here against Microsoft that potentially will be used against them very shortly. Well, I want to thank all of our guests for joining us today, our Technology Liberation Front contributors, Tim Lee of the Cato Institute and Braden Cox of ACT. And I also want to thank Fred von Lohmann of the Electronic Frontier Foundation for joining us. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap us up for this week. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. And if you'd like to comment on something that any of our contributors said here today on the podcast, you can leave a comment on our website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast and leave a comment on the page for today's show. By the way, if you like what you heard, please tell a friend and write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.